All right, you guys. This is the good part. Now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. Please offer a warm Valley Group welcome to Jeff.
You're welcome. Good evening. How you doing? My name is Jeff. I'm an alcoholic. And thanks to Bill for inviting me and Danielle, making me feel welcome. Congratulations to our one-year person and anybody who celebrated even one day. I'm glad you're here. I will refer to my notes because I haven't spoken about 3 years and everything's kind of a blur. So my sobriety date is June 25th, 1990. So I know I barely look 30, but I got just celebrated 26 years. I like to start out by saying that I was an alcoholic waiting to happen. And what I mean by that is I had a lot of the behaviors that an alcoholic would have from day one. A lot of blackouts, passing out, just a lot of the behaviors that you would have for somebody that drank for 20 or 30 years. And I live in Clovis right now. I was raised in Fresno my whole life. I live in Clovis for about the last 10 years. I say that I was had a very normal childhood. I have a twin brother. He's an alcoholic as well. He's 20 years sobriety, which is good. Both parents drank all the way till they died. So came from an alcoholic home. Life was good, but there was some weird stuff happening. We would find bottles of pop-off vodka all over the place, in my bedroom, in the closet, in the couch. You'd just be laying around somewhere and reach, oh, empty, of course, but is that normal? I don't know. But growing up, it seemed normal. And everybody drank. So as I got older, when things started going wrong, I still thought that was normal. So, I remember the first time having a beer with my dad over in the coast, maybe 12 years old. It was Olympia. I don't know if they even make that anymore. But had a sip of Olympia at 12. It was a hot summer day in Santa Cruz. We were having a barbecue. And that was pretty nice. That felt pretty good. And didn't have anything else for maybe another year. And then the next time I drank was blackberry brandy. And it felt warm going down. And I kind of like said, hey, this is it. I found my magic thing to make me happy. And would start drinking on the weekends only. And we did that because life was hard, We're in like the eighth grade and there's a lot of stress. So you got to, relax on the weekend. And we'd pimp beer. I don't know if anybody, if they do that anymore or use that term where you'd find some guy, my age now and go buy us some beer. And I think about that. I wouldn't do that for anybody today. Yeah, I'll buy you some. And maybe sometimes they take the beer with them and you'd be screwed. But you take your chance, but drinking on the weekends, not too many problems. Turned 16. Dad took us out of school to go get our driver's license, which we thought was pretty cool. But in hindsight, a lot of times you shouldn't give a young man a license at 16. In hindsight, we shouldn't have had it till we were 21. I was very angry as a young guy, and I would a lot of times drive 100 miles an hour, drunk or not, and just a lot of reckless behavior. So the first DUI I got was when I graduated when I was 18, which is, a lot of people, they go into college, they go take a trip around the world. I got a DUI, right? And then 6 months later, in November of that year, I got my second DUI with a hit and run. And that was over in on Belmont and Clovis Avenue. I hit somebody, and I was in a Nova, and they were in a Suburban. And I blacked out and kept driving until Jensen Avenue, and I pulled over, and I had like a suitcase of beer in my car in the front seat. And I remember that because the next day, me and my dad went to get my car when it was totaled, and I took two things out of there, the radio and what was left of my suitcase of beer. And that's not normal behavior. And Dad let me do that, you know? And I was looking at jail time. And I'm not somebody that probably would do well in jail. So I was kind of worried about that. And you think I would have stopped drinking, right? I had like a 0.28 alcohol level. Fully alcoholic. But I didn't stop. But what I started doing was the fun white powder, you know? Cocaine. And then that progressed, a little bit of crank, but then it progressed into freebasing. They don't call it that anymore, but crack, right? So then we're full into that, and here I am from Fresno, north side of Fresno, driving to parts of town I shouldn't be going to, and running up to, you know, drive your car up, about eight guys come up, try to sell you a little rock, and who knows what it is? It's wax, it's, you know, you have no idea what it is. You go back home, and then, hey, we got burned, and you drive back and, you know, go back and get the same thing, that same insane behavior, like it's going to be something different. But what that allowed me to do was drink without getting drunk and pass out and hungover, you know. I could do a little bit of that and then drink and, you know, drink like a gentleman. And so that went on for about, maybe 3 years or so. And throughout that time, I was working. I had a job. I worked actually at TGI Fridays as a cook. And I would get off work at 5, and I wouldn't eat all day, and I'd get off work, and I'd go have order of chicken wings. That was my dinner. And I'd have a couple of tall beers, and they'd float a little Absolut vodka, and then I'd have a couple of kamikazes, and then I'd drive, and sometimes I'd drive by my parents' house and go mix a few drinks over there on the way home. That's normal, right? Yeah. Yeah, you're in your 20s, you go by your parents' house, make some cocktails, and then I'd go home and I'd get like a half pint or a pint of vodka, and I'd just pass out. And, you know, there's some humor when you drink. My roommate, I lived with him for a few years, and one night I had a habit of leaving the stove on and all night, or I'd leave the front door open, and I'd wake up in the morning and the front door's wide open. And one night I passed out on the couch, and my roommate in the morning goes, "Hey, you know what you did last night?" "No." "You got naked and you went and, you know, got in a fight with the neighbors." And for about a half hour, I'm like, "No, come on, really?" And no, of course I didn't, but, you know, just, it's on and on with the insanity. And so many, you know, but again, it's normal. All my friends are doing it. Parents are, you know, alcoholic. Dad is alcoholic. So keep doing that. I'm probably skipping a few things, so let me look at my notes here. So, kind of like, you know, going through this, kind of turning into a little depression, you know, because with the drugs and the alcohol. Finally, towards the end, what happened? I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, and that's kind of the, you know, the cliche we hear about. But it was true for me. I was working, but I wasn't going anywhere. I hadn't acquired anything. You know, I had like a $400 car. I had one pair of pants, one pair of shoes, you know. And so I wasn't like the country song where the guy that, you know, when he's older, he loses everything and then he gets it all back at the, you know, his end of his life. But I had not lost anything. I hadn't acquired anything. So, to get to, you know, kind of the hope part, I got real sick with bronchitis, and I couldn't shake it for a year. But maybe it's because I smoked like a pack or a pack and a half of cigarettes a day, drank every day. Maybe that kind of the cause of it. I don't know. But so I went to this doctor, and it was kind of a God thing. I had insurance at the time, right? I was able to have insurance at a part-time job. So I went to the doctor, and He saw me and he gave me some free medicine to get rid of the bronchitis. But he also asked me, he goes, "Hey, do you have a problem with drinking?" You know, and I'm like, "No." You know, "Why do you ask?" And because obviously I look like shit, you know. And so I told him how much I drank, and then he said, "Well, you might be an alcoholic." And I said, "Okay." And he said, one thing he said is he had his own opinion on alcoholism. So he goes, you know, he wanted to help me, but he also wanted to tell me his opinion. And he said if he had his choice, he'd put all the alcoholics in alcoholic town, all together corralled in a little town. And I'm like, okay, you're trying to help me, but you're kind of slamming me at the same time. But I'm so, you know, I'm just so beat down and tired that I just want help, right? So he says, "I can't help you, but I another person like you, I sent him to a treatment center, and I'm going to give you that information, and they can help you." So I said, "Okay." So I got the courage up. I called that place. It was called ARS, not around anymore. It was an outpatient facility. Barry and Mary ran it. I don't know, maybe some of you might know them, but Mary's still around. Barry passed away a few years ago. Great people, both, you know, in the program 20, 30 years. And so I got over there, and the first day I went in, it was like 9 in the morning, and I was real shaky, you know. And he goes, "Hey, you want a cup of coffee?" And I said, "Why?" "Because you look like you need it." "Okay." And I got it. And so we started talking, and he asked me, he goes, what do you want to get out of this?" And I said, "I want peace of mind." And he goes, "You'll get it." And so from that point on, that was like step two and step three early, because I had faith in him. He was the God at that time, and I had faith in him that I was going to get better, and if he could do it, I could do it, because he was a real squirrely guy. He was a good guy, but he had a long, you know, a good story, and I just figured, man, if you can do it, I can do it. So before I went in, though, my mom and dad went there. I was 25 at the time, so my mom and dad went there. My brother went there kind of for family day or something. And yeah, see, he looked at my dad. He goes, "Hey, you know, I told Dad, you want to do it too?" "No, you know." He's probably 50, he was 50 at that time or something, 55. And he asked my brother, and my brother's like, "No, I don't need that." And he goes, "We'll see you later." You know, sure enough, he did, you know, get sober later. But by joining that, it cost $2,400. And again, I'm making $8 an hour as a cook. I have no money. I got nothing. And but I had insurance at my job, which is bizarre. You know, who would have thought? And that was covered under the plan. But I signed on the dotted line, not knowing if it was going to pay, if I could pay for it. And he goes, "Just, you know, let's just run the insurance, see what happens." And they paid all but about $300, which I could afford. So again, it was that leap of faith thing, you know what I mean? Like, just do it. Just keep moving forward. You know, something good's going to happen from it. So I got involved in that. And what helped with that, we worked the first three steps using the 12x12. And, you know, most people get sober with the big book. We got the first three steps through the 12x12, and we had to, there was about 10 or 12 of us in the, that would meet four times a week, and then we would go to AA meetings on the weekends. So we were doing something around sobriety for 8 weeks every single day. You know, they talk about 90 and 90, right? Same idea. And then we had aftercare, and so it was like a 6 month long deal, the whole thing. So we had to work the first three steps, and for the first step we had to write it out and present it in front of everybody. And you know, there was a buddy of mine who's a sheriff, and he took it real serious. He got his Wrangler jeans with it all pressed in the front, like a real crease you could cut glass with, cowboy hat, big belt, looking sharp. "I'm gonna do my thing, yeah, here I go." And he failed, and he cried, you know, because he wasn't getting real, and he had to do it again. And luckily I passed, you know. And I say I'm lucky, but it's because I was ready and I really wanted it at that point, you know. And I see people coming now that, you know, people I work with, and it's like, are you really done? You know, like back in the day when I got sober, you know, it was kind of different back then. It was like, hey, man, if you want to go out and do some more research, go do it. You know, either you're all in or you're not. You know, it's either you're hot or you're cold. It's not in between. So I was all in. So did step one, got through step three, and then had to get a temporary sponsor. So, which is typical of most programs, you have to get a temporary sponsor. So I asked a guy, they say find somebody that you identify with. So I had a guy who had like a mullet, he had long hair, he had a tattoo of a frog smoking a joint or something on his arm, and yeah, and he shot pool, which was fun, cool, and he liked the Broncos, which I don't, but the guy was head to toe in orange and white, shoelaces, white and orange, and just, and he also, back this in 1990, he was the coolest guy because he had a portable phone that was this big. Right? You know, and it had a big leather case and, you know, didn't even have cell phones back then. So, and this is the scary thing when you have to go ask somebody to be your sponsor, and it's like, I was scared to death. But I was going to a meeting at Manchester Mall, and it was Brooks Ranch or Country Waffles, one of the two, and it was packed. I mean, packed house Saturday and Sunday. You had to get there early. But he ran one of those meetings, and he ran it like a watch. I mean, he was all over it. And I asked him, would you be my temporary sponsor? And he didn't say yes right away. He's like, I'll let you know or something. Like, oh, crap. You know. But he said yes. And so I worked the rest of the steps with him as best as we could. And doing the fourth step with him, I really thought that my secrets, all the things I've done were that nobody else had done them, you know, that I was unique. And so he kind of shared his story first, and then I thought, oh my God, wow, that's a great story, you know. He did 10 times worse things than I did. So that really put me at ease, right? So then I was able to tell him my story, and we worked the steps together. And he was my sponsor for about 3 or 4 years. And then, you know, things go. You just kind of move on to somebody else. So, you know, things are going good in sobriety. You know, Grandma passed away, I got some money, I got a truck, I got a new job, went to school. You know, things start happening. Then I found out I was a dad of a 2-year-old daughter that mom thought it was a few other guys first till it got to me, and I did the blood test, and they said it's 96% positive that it's you. And I'm like, well, it ain't 100. You know? Not 100. And maybe my twin brother was with her too. Maybe not. He was. That's a whole nother story. But, so, I had that going on, so I had to stop going to school and get a full-time job, and I did, and, you know, it's all good. And my daughter's doing great now. She's 26, obviously. And so then I got married, right? And to a different gal. Not that gal, but a different gal. Had another kid. And was going to AA. Everything going great. But about 1999, about 9 years in, I decided to go to church. My wife said, this is awesome, hey, let's take the kids to church. Okay. But I can't go on Sunday because I'm working, so you go find one for them. So I did. I went to all different kinds and found one that we liked finally, and we got baptized to that in 1999. And really for like 10 years, I was more into church and getting fully involved in that, being in service, and didn't go much to AA, wasn't in service in AA, and didn't, 1 year I didn't go to meetings at all. And my brother at this point was, you know, fully into AA, so much into service, and he'd tell me, how do you do it, man? And I'm like, I don't know, I'm just, you know, it's going, life was going good, right? Yeah, with no problems, everything was good, until like 2009, when the economy took a crap, And, you know, I went from a lot of money up to a lot of money down, and things started going the wrong way. So I, you know, instead of making bad decisions and going out and drinking or something, he got me back. So I helped him get sober, because when he was at the very end, he came to me. And it was cool because I was ready for him, right? I had all the stuff laid out. And I'm old school in that this is a program of attraction, not promotion. So I'm not the type that goes out and, you know, beats people over the head. You need to get this. And, you know, it's attraction. My whole thing is that I need to live my life so that somebody looks at me and says, I want what he's got. And I'm not saying I do that, a great job of that, but that's my lifelong goal, right? So I guess I did it good enough, because about 6 years in, he came to my house one night, down and out, and I was ready. I go, here you go. I've got it all here. I said, but I can't help you. I can't be your sponsor. But I turned him on to somebody else who was and was able to. And it's funny, before he got sober, he read a book, and he goes, hey, man, I read this book, and it said that there are cases where there's twins, and one could be alcoholic and one's not. And that's what we got here, right? I said, you're reading the wrong book, man. I got this other book. Let's check that out. So, but getting back to my story, so he, at this point, he's really super involved, and there was a meeting with 12 people, and we called it the 12 guys working the 12 steps or something. And it was really about people bringing their sponsees in, right? So I didn't have a sponsor at the time, so I got one of the guys, I asked him to be my a new sponsor. That was my second sponsor. And from that, I got back into service, and I really started sponsoring people for the first time after probably 20 years of sobriety. Nobody ever asked me. I'd help people get in the program and get involved, but I wasn't directly their sponsor. And so I started doing that, and then eventually I started helping out with CAP Recovery out on Whitesbridge out there. I do some service work out there. I'm on PICPC committee, Public Information Committee. We do things. And pretty soon I'm involved in 4 service commitments, and which is good, because for me, the one thing that keeps me out of my head is getting into service. One time we had to go speak at Fresno State to some students about sobriety, and I was talking to them about the voices in my head, you know, and there was a Q&A afterwards. She goes, hey, tell me more about those voices. And I'm like, well, it's not like the kind where telling me to go to Walmart and shoot everybody with a pink shirt on, you know. It's not that. It's, you know, it's me telling myself I'm no good, right? And just beating myself up more so than anybody else, and or getting into worry and fear, and which I can get to in 5 seconds. I can get into that. But the one thing that gets me out of that is being in the service, because when I'm in service, I'm into that. I'm in the moment, and I'm not into anything else. I'm not thinking about me. I'm into somebody else, getting out of myself. So that's the one thing I can pass along, or any suggestion I can make, is get into service right away, early. Which that wasn't told to me in the beginning by my sponsor. He didn't tell me, "Hey, go now you're work the steps. Now you need to go, you know, get a sponsee. You need to be a secretary at a meeting. Blah blah blah." I think I could have used that push back then. So I try to do that with people that we sponsor today. We get them involved in whatever we go shooting or whatever we're doing. We bring them into that, and we have them get into service right away. And, you know, it's usually pretty successful. So now I'm sponsoring 2 guys. One guy doing really well. He's got about a year and a half. Another guy was doing excellent, and then got involved in a gal, and you know that goes. Can go either way. Gal gets involved with a guy, but kind of took his eye off what was important. But now he's back. And then now I have another guy that I work with, and his mom called me the other day out of the blue to tell me, hey, I want to talk to you about my son Carlos. And at first I thought it was usually a complaint from one of my stores that the managers, you know, pissed them off or something. And I'm like, oh boy, here we go. And so she mentioned the guy's name. And I'm like, oh yeah, that, you know, I can absolutely help him. And so I got with him again, and he was embarrassed because he went through the detox at CAP, and then he started drinking again. But now he was so embarrassed he couldn't talk to me. And I'm like, there's nothing to be embarrassed about, man. We have a disease, you know. I mean, just get, you know, let's get back into it. And but he's scared about the unknown, you know. I'm talking to his mom, and we've got the. I try to fix things. I've got the detox lined up. I'm working with his mom. We got the outpatient lined up. It's all paid for. All you have to do, take a week off from work. I'll help you with that. Go do, you know, bop, bop, bop. And, you know, so in my mind, it's like, just do it, man. That's all you got to do. And I told him, I go, hey, give me a call. I texted him. He goes, yeah, but I'm scared. You know, like, you know, he likes to party, you know, with the girls and the club and all that. And he goes, you know, they don't have a problem, but I do. And what am I going to tell them now that I don't drink? And I say, you just tell them you don't drink, man. Don't worry about it. There's a lot of fishies in the sea. You know, if they're not right for you, they're not right for you. But I think that's what happens. And it's the same thing that happened with my wife's brother who died of this disease. Same thing. He was living in a boat in San Francisco. And we drove over there. We got him hooked up in the VA. We had like a year or 2 year long worth of program. And all he had to do was show up. And he was scared to come back and do it because he said, well, what's going to happen afterwards? What do I do after I'm done with all that? I don't know, man. I don't know what I'm going to be doing in 2 years either. But I know I'm going to be sober. And I know if I keep doing what I'm doing, God's going to provide good things, right? And, but you know, he couldn't do it. And he did it before, but he couldn't do it this time. And, you know, we buried him. He died of this disease. And it was sad. He was a young guy. He was like 54, about 4 years older than me. And, you know, I just feel really fortunate and lucky that me and my brother, I mean, we're really tight. And there is no good reason why we are sober today. None. We should not be here. I mean, you know, when they say a real alcoholic, I feel like a real alcoholic. I may have not done a lot of the things that so many other people have done, but, you know, we sure have the disease, but I don't think I could go back out there again and come back. I don't know that. I don't want to test that today, you know what I mean? So I'm glad you asked me to share tonight, and I think I'll just leave it at that. Thank you. Thanks.